Peace train sounding loud, glide on the peace train. Come on, peace train.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. He was born Stephen Dimitri Georgiou, son of a Greek Cypriot London restaurateur and a Swedish Baptist mother. He gained fame as Cat Stevens. His hits helped define the 60s and 70s pop music world. There was Moonshadow, Wild World, Morning Has Broken, Peace Train, Miles from Nowhere, and many more. In the late 70s, the singer-songwriter converted to Islam. In 1977, Cat Stevens became Yusuf Islam.
I've been happy lately, thinking about the good things to come, and I believe it could be someday it's going to come. Well, I've been smiling lately, dreaming about the world as one, and I believe it could be someday it's going to come.
He turned his back on the music business and became a benefactor of and spokesman for the British Islamic community. He donated funds to Muslim orphanages around the world. He founded three Islamic schools in Britain. He was also expelled from Israel in 2000 for allegedly funding Hamas in 1988, a charge he denied. Then, on Tuesday, he was on a plane from London bound for Washington with his 21-year-old daughter when the FBI found out he was on board. The flight was diverted to Bangor, Maine. Yusuf Islam, it turns out, is on the American no-fly list. He was deported back to Britain on national security grounds, according to the Department of Homeland Security. Mobbed by reporters at London's Heathrow Airport, Islam, once Cat Stevens, had this to say.
The whole thing is totally ridiculous. Everybody knows who I am. You know, I'm no secret figure. Everybody knows my campaigning for charity, for peace, and there's got to be a whole lot of explanations. But, you know, for God's sake, people make mistakes. I just hope that they've made a big mistake.
Cat Stevens sang as a man of peace. He returned to popular music with this 2003 recording of his signature hit, Peace Train, and donated the proceeds to charities aiding children in Iraq. He's also supported survivors of the 9/11 terror attacks in America. American security officials now say he's a threat. Tonight on Point, the musical and spiritual evolution of a one-time pop star, Cat Stevens, Yusuf Islam.
Someday it's going to come. Someday it's going to come. Someday, someday, someday it's going to come.
We begin tonight with more on the no-fly list that targeted Yusuf Islam and why he may have been on it. Joining me now from Washington is Mimi Hall, reporter for USA Today. Mimi, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
So can you describe to us this list that Cat Stevens, Yusuf Islam, got caught up in?
Sure. The government has a couple of several different kinds of lists. They have terrorist watch lists, which are much larger lists that include all sorts of people that they want to keep an eye on or bring in for additional questioning before they allow them on a flight. And apparently, Cat Stevens had been on those lists for a number of years because of donations to Hamas and some other charitable groups that the government was concerned about. There's a separate list, though, called the no-fly list. And this is a smaller list than the bigger watch lists. And those people on this list are believed by our government to have been involved with those who have made specific threats against aviation, and they are flat out not allowed to come into the country. They are not people who will be taken aside for extra questioning. They're just flat out not allowed to come in.
Now, was Yusuf Islam, Cat Stevens, on that second list or just the first?
He was on the second list as of late July of this year when Homeland Security officials and other administration officials say they got new intelligence about him that caused them to elevate their level of concern about him from earlier sort of more general concerns that had him on watch lists, and that's when they put him on the no-fly list.
And because he was on this second higher security list, as I understand it, that's why the flight was diverted not just from Washington but away from the entire Washington-New York-Boston corridor all the way to Bangor, Maine.
Sure. Well, if they figure out once a flight is in the air that there's somebody on it who shouldn't be allowed entry into this country, they're not going to let that flight anywhere near heavily populated areas. So They sent it up to Maine, which was the closest international airport that could accept the plane in a sort of sparsely populated area.
Right. Mimi, I want to come back to Yusuf Islam, but on this wider list again, we've also been hearing the 9/11 Commission suggesting that the government take over responsibility for this, charges that United, which had the flight coming from London, shouldn't have let Yusuf Islam, Cat Stevens, on in the first place. And what's the move? To take it from the private airlines and put it in government hands to survey and to keep track of?
That's right. The way it works right now and has worked for many years is that the government provides the no-fly list to individual airlines who then check passengers' names against it. Whether United made a mistake here or not is not clear, because it may be that Yusuf Islam was spelled differently than what he used for booking the flight. And so United may or may not have made a mistake. But regardless, even before the 9/11 Commission came out and made this recommendation, the government was already moving to take control of these lists, and so that individual airlines with people who are trained in different ways aren't all looking at these lists and making individual decisions. What will happen when this plan goes into place, which will be sometime next year, is that the airlines will hand over the names and other information about their passengers to the government before flights take off. The government will run all those names against the no-fly and watch lists.
So every time people fly, their names will be processed through the government computers on the security front.
That's correct.
So let's come back to Yusuf Islam for a moment, Mimi Hall. It was only a few months ago, as I understand it, he was in the White House or talking with White House officials. Now here we are in September, and an entire flight is diverted many hundreds of miles, and he is diverted straight out of the country. What happened in those intervening months to
right.
put him on such a high security status?
Well, we don't really know. What I can tell you is that some government officials have told me on deep background, and they don't like to have their names used because these watch list issues have become very sensitive, because there have been a number of instances in the press, like Senator Kennedy, his name appeared on one of these watch lists, and he kept getting pulled aside at airports for all these extra questioning.
Right.
So they're very sensitive about these lists, but I am told by some government officials that there's recent information about him that they've proven that some of the money that he has donated to Hamas and also to some other groups has gone directly to funding terrorist activities, including the blind sheikh convicted in the 93 World Trade Center bombings. Additionally, that he has been associating with some people in some London mosques who our government say have made direct flights against our aviation system. So it's hard to get a clear picture, but it sounds to me some of it is guilt by association, it sounds like. And they're reticent to talk about these details and the kinds of things they pick up through intelligence, but they are not so far backing away from their determination that he does belong on that no-fly list.
Well, a very dramatic move on Tuesday night, and one we're going to look into the background of here tonight. Mimi Hall, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Mimi Hall, a reporter for USA Today. She joined me from Washington.
Listen to the wind of my soul. Where I'll end up, well, I think only God really knows. I've sat upon the setting sun, but never, 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 never. I never wanted water once. Never, never, never.
We're talking tonight about the evolution of a pop star, a man, Cat Stevens, now Yusuf Islam. Flight turned back on Tuesday night, keeping him from entering the United States. The reports are that the security man who took him, the FBI, were asking for his autograph, but they were shipping him out nonetheless. I'm joined now from Los Angeles by David Wilde. He's a longtime contributing editor to Rolling Stone, an Emmy-nominated television writer. He was producer of the year 2000 VH1 special on Cat Stevens, where he extensively interviewed Yusuf Islam. He won a Muslim Public Policy Award for that special. David Wilde, thanks for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
And from New York, Anthony DeCurtis, also a contributing editor at Rolling Stone and author of Rocking My Life Away. Anthony DeCurtis, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, of course.
I guess the first place to go is right back to the beginning, because many people know his songs, and it's surprising how many are still so prominent. Sheryl Crow is out now with what, The First Cut Is the Deepest. I had no idea, or had forgotten in any case, that was a Cat Stevens song. David Wilde, take us all the way back to the beginning here. Who was Cat Stevens?
Cat Stevens started out in sort of the London, swinging London pop era, sort of, Mike Myers could play the early Cat Stevens, and he had a number of pop hits, Matthew and Son being one of them, First Cut Is the Deepest, and then he very quickly became one of the defining singer-songwriters, the quote-unquote sensitive singer-songwriters of the 70s, and a guy who, you know, I have tremendous respect for as an artist. When I met him, I told him that he had attended my bar mitzvah, although he didn't realize it, because when I was a kid, he was really one of my absolute heroes. So it was, actually getting to work with him and get to know him was interesting, even without all the outside political interests.
Yeah, Anthony DeCurtis, he became Cat Stevens and now Yusuf Islam, but neither of those were his original name. A Greek Cypriot father, a Swedish Baptist mother, and he was born, what, Stephen?
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure of the pronunciation, but it's George. He was, and in fact, I mean, he's written about the fact and spoken about the fact that his father actually had pretty strong sort of anti-Islamic feelings. His father was a Greek Cypriot. So, you know, he grew up in the kind of tempest of all of that kind of, multicultural pot that is, you know, certain parts of London. And, he was raised Catholic. And, and then became a pop star when he was quite young, actually.
And a very, very big pop star. I mean, these were songs that were absolutely defining of that whole quarter, that sensitive singer-songwriter quarter, Anthony DeCurtis, that David Wilde mentioned.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was a kind of sweetness, you know, both to his voice and to, and to the kind of songs that he sang. You know, they were often about women. He had some very prominent girlfriends, you know, like Carly Simon and Patti Darvinville, and he was a player, essentially. I mean, he was, you know, somebody who was out there, was a good-looking guy, you know, is kind of romantic, and you know, I think both men and women, you know, were drawn to, there was a, you know, it was just kind of vague mysticism and a kind of pastel-colored, quality to the songs that he did that, they're still pretty irresistible. They're very nicely done.
And then David Wilde, in 1976, he's swimming off the coast of Malibu. Of course, he was a pop star. He's being carried out to sea. And how does he describe what happened there and how it relates to his conversion?
Well, I should say my own feeling, having spent a lot of time with him and discussing all this, is that the story that, you know, you see on a Behind the Music even is a reduction of the bigger story. He says his moment of conversion was when he was in Malibu and sort of found himself unable to get back to shore. I think there's a bit of a metaphor that he likes there. In truth, I think he was always a seeker. I think that's what came through in the music. Anthony mentioned the vagueness of it. I think that's very appropriate. I think he was always sort of looking for something and had no idea what it was, and I think went through stardom, which is, you know, confusing and frightening for many people, and I think was especially for him. And then, but I think in truth, the conversion was a much more gradual and complex story than simply nearly drowning and saying, I better get right with God.
We're talking tonight about Yusuf Islam, once Cat Stevens. Here's On the Road to Find Out from his 1970 album, Tea for the Tiller Man. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Yusuf Islam, once known as Cat Stevens.
Miles from nowhere, guess I'll take my time. Oh, yeah. To reach there, look up at the mountain I have to climb. Oh, yeah. To reach there, Lord, my body has been a good friend, but I won't meet it when I reach the end. Miles from nowhere, I guess I take my time.
Cat Stevens, now Yusuf Islam, deported from the United States, his entire flight diverted to Bangor, Maine on Tuesday night, him shipped straight out, giving autographs to the FBI as he went. It's a fascinating story and a mystery in many elements. Behind us right now, Miles from Nowhere from his 1970 T for the Tillerman album, but he stopped all that at a certain point. We're joined tonight from Los Angeles by David Wilde. He did a VH1 special on Yusuf Islam. And from New York by Anthony DeCurtis, author of Rocking My Life Away. We're joined right now from London by Sam Coates, a reporter for the London Times. Sam, thanks very much for being with us.
Hello, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Sam, tell us about Yusuf Islam's role in the UK today and how these charges that he is or may be linked to terrorism are being received there.
Well, I think the whole incident has been quite an embarrassment for both sides. For the US administration, it's been a bad patch, and lots of people over here are quite critical about the way it's handled. Make no mistake, Yusuf Islam is today a moderate figure. He's the governor of a school in North London, a pioneering school, one of the first Muslim schools, all-Muslim school, to get funding from the government, which was quite a milestone. He's acclaimed by the Muslim Association of Great Britain, which is the kind of moderate mainstream group, and he's a big figure in the charity world. He works for Sergeant Cancer Care and several other organizations. So I think today there is no doubt that there was no chance that Yusuf Islam was a clear and present danger on that flight. It just looks ridiculous that his flight was diverted 600 miles, that the FBI appeared to panic. There was no reason to do that, it seems, from everything that we know about this man today.
Jack Straw, the British Foreign Secretary, who's been in New York this week at the big UN meeting, complained to Colin Powell, saying Yusuf Islam should not have been taken and deported in that way. And it sounds like you're saying that that's a kind of consensus in the UK, but I heard a but coming there.
Just very quickly, of course, Yusuf Islam, a friend of New Labour, of the Blair government. He has met Tony Blair. He has met David Blunkett, the Home Secretary. He's also met Prince Charles. Very much an establishment figure now. But the difficulty for Mr. Islam is that this incident really does encourage us to dredge up some of the less pleasant incidents from his past. This is not a guy who has had a totally blameless past. Very much today, he's considered a moderate, but he now seems to be reaping the reward or the sort of punishment for things that he said and perhaps actions that he took in his arguably more militant days in the 1980s.
Such as? Well,
the most important one that we can never forget is that you may remember Salman Rushdie, a British author,
sure,
wrote the Satanic Verses, and the Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran said that took out a fatwa on him saying that he must be executed. And Yusuf Islam was almost immediately came out very strongly in support of the Ayatollah. He said he has got to be killed. He said the Quran makes it clear that if somebody defames the Prophet, then he must die. There was even a suggestion that Yusuf Islam said that if nobody else would do it, he would do it with his own hands. And in a phrase that I think will resonate over at your side of the Atlantic, he said, let's face it, America has the atom bomb. This is a deterrent, being able to blow up a nation of people. What we are talking about is a deterrent for individuals to be careful not to disturb the society in which they live. He said it on the record interview in the Washington Post from 1991, which is pretty extreme stuff. There have been numerous other examples of extreme language from him. He said that AIDS is a punishment from Allah. He said that the State of Israel did not deserve to exist. Many of these extreme statements coming, as I said, in the 1980s, comments that you'd be hard-pressed to get him to repeat these days.
And in fact, he's on the record all over the place, before 9/11 and since, saying this is wrong, this killing is wrong, Islam is and should be a peaceful religion, you know, that theme.
You know, it's very hard for people to get around this idea that the guy who wrote The Peace Train, one of his most memorable songs, also said that Salman Rushdie has got to be killed. And then there's this other very, very difficult area, which I suspect had something to do with him being added to the American watch list, and this is the question of his links to Hamas and terrorism. It must be made absolutely clear, he strongly denies funding terrorists. The reason that this allegation surfaces was from when he was deported from Israel in 2000, when Israeli spokesman said, again, on the record to Reuters and other news organizations, that the reason that he was being barred is because they believe that he passed money to a charity that then got diverted to Hamas. Interestingly, the incident to which they referred again happened during the 80s. It was in 1988, during what Mr. Islam calls a humanitarian mission, that he brought money which Israel later said went into Hamas and into terrorism.
So he said it went to hospitals, they said it went to terrorism.
That sort of thing. He's quite categorical that that's not the truth. And, I mean, the problem for journalists such as myself is the problem is that you can never really go back to an Israeli spy or an Israeli intelligence source and cross-question them about their evidence.
And so it sits there on the record. Sam Coates in London, stand by for just a minute. David Wild, if we could speak to these. I know you talked with Cat Stevens, Yusuf Islam, about these charges, in particular about the uproar over his comments on Salman Rushdie and the satanic verses. What was his explanation or response?
Well, frankly, the entire project that we did with him was, I believe, his way of atoning and also basically in the most elevated way, doing some sort of public relations to reconnect with the American audience, the American musical audience, and to be to find acceptance. And to, I think, basically, as the previous gentleman was explaining, I think he, when he made the conversion to Islam, I think he was, as is often with the convert, you know, a more zealous figure. And the Yusuf Islam that I met in 2000, a very spiritual man, a very intelligent man, and a very calm presence, and certainly nothing, no one I would worry about flying next to on a plane. Interestingly, the event that you were speaking of in Israel happened as part of the production for the show we were doing.
This is in the year 2000 when he was barred from entering.
That was actually for VH1. He was flying to Israel. I spent a week or so with him in London, in all the places he had grown up and worked and lived, interviewing him for the show. And then the production team went on to Israel to shoot basically scenes, because that's where he went through his conversion in a formal way. He was at a mosque in Jerusalem when he asked to be accepted, you know, as a Muslim. And we were traveling there. Well, actually, I perhaps wisely in retrospect thought, listen, a nice Jewish boy from New Jersey is not going to make that particular trip with him. And I had to go home and see my family. But the rest of them went on from London the next day to Israel, and they were turned back. And I know he was outraged at the time.
What did he say about the allegation was that his 1988 contribution of some tens of thousands of dollars had ended up in the hands of security threats rather than hospitals?
This is where the story gets hopelessly complicated, because the fact of the matter is the man does tirelessly work for any number of charities. It's not just one or two. It's many, and I witnessed. He sort of, he's pretty much, when he cut back on music, he became a full-time good doer, at least within his world, was perceived as such. And I think the complication is it's hard to follow this particular money trail. And it's, personally, I do not think his intention, like, it's hard for me to accept that the man I came to know would be willfully funding terrorists. It's hard to know, it's hard for any of us to know where the money that he was raising went.
The awkward fact is that Hamas does both have clinics and have terrorists. And there we are. Sam Coates, I know I've just got you for another minute here. Bring us up to date. You began by saying that Cat Stevens, Yusuf Islam's reputation in the U.K. today is entirely one of a moderate. Do you think that these U.S. charges will change that? Washington's sticking by them.
It is embarrassing, and it does dredge up the past. People inevitably ask questions when something like this happens. There is a very negative perception in Britain at the moment of the U.S. visa process and the entry process that means that there are now very stringent rules for getting into the U.S. If you're a U.K. citizen, everybody, as you'll be aware, who goes to the U.S. from the U.K.
Yep.
has now got to be fingerprinted and photographed. So there is a sort of overwhelming public hostility and public disgruntlement with the whole process. So from that point of view, that means there is slightly more sympathy for Mr. Islam. But nonetheless, all of this does dredge up very specific allegations. And your other contributor said to you, well, you can't see how you can reconcile the person you know with the allegations that have been made. But again, this is a guy who in the 80s was making far more extreme statements than he is today and was much more of a sort of wildfire loose cannon, who, of course, had close dealings with Saddam Hussein in the early 90s.
I didn't know that. What sort of dealings?
He visited Saddam Hussein before the First Gulf War and was very critical of the U.S. and the West and their plans for invasion, even after the Iraq invaded Kuwait. He came back from Iraq shortly before the invasion and told an international newspaper, "It seems to me that Saddam Hussein has a convincing argument." And here is something that you'll find fascinating. In the same interview, he said, "Iraq is not the only place where human rights are being abused. What about the Canadian Indians?" So this is a guy who draws moral equivalence that many people would find difficult to accept. It was 15 years ago. He does appear to have changed, but nonetheless, you can see why somebody when there are very strict rules that stop anybody with a criminal record from any other country getting in, and anyone who's made extreme statements, then you can see how a person like this could end up on a passenger watch list. And let's be clear, those watch lists are there for anybody with a suspect past to be investigated.
But this isn't just the general watch list. This is the one that says this person is a threat to aviation. It's the more acute list. I have to say, it's hard to square that with his more recent statements, which have been very peace and reconciliation and understanding-oriented, he's aghast at what's happened with the Islamist violence. But as you say, there's a record there.
There is a record, and this is something that the U.S. authorities have clearly thought about and chosen to take a course of action, but whether it's the right one, we won't know because they won't tell us.
Hard to square with the old music that everybody knows and loves. Sam Coates with the London Times, thank you so much for being with us. Let's listen to just a little bit of a Yusuf Islam recording from 2000 from an album called A is for Allah. This is Bismillah.
Ba. Bismillah.
Bismillah means in the name of Allah. These are the first words which begin the glorious Quran. Muslims are taught to mention the name of Allah whenever beginning anything.
So we're a long way from T for the Tillerman there. Anthony DeCurtis, what do you know about Cat Stevens recording since he converted to Islam?
Well, I mean, I think they've been along these lines, he's certainly not recording anything that we would remotely think of as pop songs or, anything in the style of what he originally done and why, he still played on the radio here. They're very much in keeping with his current faith and his current set of interests.
Clearly, it's interest in teaching in particular, and he's got a big interest in schools, Islamic schools in the U.K., David Wild, take us through those steps then. After his conversion, his whatever it happened in the off the beach in Malibu, he goes to Jerusalem, he goes to the mosque, he takes the new name. And then, as I understand, he had an arranged marriage. I think it's Fawzia Ali, if I've got that right.
Right. I met the woman, but considering the traditions of the people, I can't say I even got to look upon her. I was next to her, and we weren't introduced.
I see they have five children here.
Right. And his son, I know he was traveling with his daughter the other day.
Yes.
His son traveled with him a great deal when we were working with him. And, the stages have been very complex. I think initially he gradually rejected music. The truth of the matter is he fulfilled obligations for another, I believe, year or two.
I think 1981 he formally renounced his singing career, if I've got the record right.
Right, and he gave up his instruments, which there was some discussion within even his community that he did not have to necessarily walk away from music to the extent that he did. His statement to me was that he felt until he could sort it all out, the responsible thing to do would be to interpret it as strictly as possible. And I think that might be at the heart of a lot of what we're talking about, is that in that initial phase, he took a harder line than he does today. I was told directly at that school, that one of the schools that he runs, another person on the staff of that school told me, listen, the man you're meeting today is not the man you would have met, you know, a few years back. Mm. And I think he's evolved a great deal. And I think the shame of the matter is I hope that the situation doesn't sort of create tensions that, you know, bring people apart again. I can't imagine that would be something he would even want.
Well, it's striking. I mean, he's writing essays. We see them all over the UK media here, of a peace and understanding between religions. Writing later about his statements on Salman Rushdie, he said he was misrepresented by the press, that he had never supported the fatwa. But if you listen closely, he wrote, you wouldn't ask a Christian to deny one of the Ten Commandments. Equally, as a new Muslim, I couldn't deny that the Quran, just like Leviticus in the Bible, forbade blasphemy and stated that if there is no repentance, it is a capital offense. Anthony Curtis, you can hear a new convert there trying to deal with some very tough old language in the scripture.
I mean, it was indefensible, really, and he's never really backed off it. You know, he's done other things, I think. And as David pointed out, I think there was this kind of, you know, effort to smooth the edges. He certainly made some clear statements after September 11th about disapproving of those attacks and, but, you know, the Salman Rushdie thing was dark. There's no question about it. You know, like, I mean, he was looking at it. It was a question of, a convert taking the words of his new faith very, very literally, and in a situation that was, you know, a matter of concern around the world. This, I don't know, I maybe, you know, the current situation is so complicated, I think, because the reasons why someone like Yusuf Islam would end up on this list, on the one hand, you know, it's kind of understandable that he would be somebody that they would be looking at. Yeah. You know, on the other hand, it's ridiculous, and the situation here has become so completely politicized that it's hard to trust those lists.
And
it's hard to trust their accuracy, and it's hard to trust the reasons why anybody turns on. You know, this guy was critical of the Iraq War, and that, as well as anything else, could have ended up getting him on this list.
Yet Sean Penn still flies freely.
Sean Penn, the two-fisted Sean Penn. Islamic groups in the United States saying in the days since that deportation of Yusuf Islam, this is the way to alienate moderate Muslims. We've got much more to get into here on Yusuf Islam. Cat Stevens here from the year 2003, God is the Light, recorded by Yusuf Islam and friends and put out by his own record company, Mountain of Light. David Wilde, Anthony DeCurtis, stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
How great the wonder of the heavens and the timeless beauty of the night. How great, then how great the Creator. And its stars like priceless jewels, far beyond the reach of kings, bow down for the shepherd guiding him home. But how many eyes are closed to the wonder of this night, like pearls hidden deep beneath the dark stream of desires.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the evolution of a pop star, Yusuf Islam, once Cat Stevens. This is Our Guide is the Quran, from Yusuf Islam's 2000 devotional album, A is for Allah.
Our guide is the Quran, our religion is Islam.
My guest tonight, David Wilde, joining us from Los Angeles, and from New York, Anthony DeCurtis. David Wilde produced a VH1 special on Cat Stevens in the year 2000. Anthony DeCurtis is contributing editor at Rolling Stone and author of Rocking My Life Away. David Wilde, I wish you'd share with us some more of what Yusuf Islam, Cat Stevens, shared with you about his conversion and why Islam that he came around to after Zen Buddhism and Taoism and astrology, and I think he even talked about UFOs for a while.
Well, the way he put it is that, you know, he was always a seeker, and he finally found the answer in the Quran, and it spoke to him. And the hard point is, you know, who is anyone to challenge where anyone finds the truth and beauty? Yet for someone like myself, feverishly reading the Quran on the way over
to London to interview him, there were just tough questions. You know, I remember discussing with him how the man who wrote, "If you want to sing out, sing out," became a symbol of censorship in the most ugly form, you know, with Rushdie. That's where the sort of modern world and the sort of political correctness come head-to-head with anybody who takes a very hard line. And I remember a phrase he said to me in answering that question was something like, "Well, you don't let everyone out of prison, do you?"
Meaning?
Meaning that I was saying, you know, that he had expressed in that song the sort of 60s ideal of the freedom of expression. And he said, "Yes, but if you violate the law, you pay the price." And I think he's certainly attempted to make many fine distinctions on the whole Rushdie issue. But I think the difficult thing for him and the difficult thing for us, and I was really first and foremost the interviewer, and George Mall and his team at VH1 produced, I think, a special that tried to address some of these issues in a way that usually the shows are mainly addressing, you know, groupies and lesser matters.
Yeah.
But it's a very tough issue because I think he did say things that are difficult for us to hear, and I think he's tried to take steps away from them, but it comes down to there is a cultural divide in terms of what is perceived as right and wrong. And I think he will only walk so far away from a rather devout interpretation of how he perceives the law.
It's frightening how difficult it can become these days for someone to straddle these things. He's written that, look, I'm in a great position to interpret these communities one to the other, and yet it's tough. He contributed to the Survivors Fund after 9/11. He's been very active. I see here in 1999 he was part of a group that tried to deliver $30,000-$40,000 directly to Kosovo refugees, was turned back by border guards that stopped them and confiscated the money. Just last year, he re-recorded Peace Train, the 1971 hit in Johannesburg, South Africa. This is on an album that he did with Paul McCartney and David Bowie and George Michael to raise money for children in Iraq. Anthony DeCurtis, when you listen back over all these years to the Cat Stevens hits that everybody knows, how do you reconcile or see a continuity in what you hear there and the man we see and hear today?
Well, I think that what's missing here in a certain sense is whatever happened in his personal life, there was a kind of disgust with what the kind of life he had lived and what it represented. You know,
he said it was not necessarily the music or the singing, but everything else that was corrupt.
Precisely.
The drugs, sex, conceit, the unhealthy
exactly.
competition.
You know, there was, you know, the drugs were involved and drinking and girls and, you know, all of that stuff. And there's a kind of revulsion that I think set in with him that, you know, is difficult to detect, you know, except in the kind of rigor, I suppose, of some of his statements. And I think, you know, I think when that kind of emotion sets in, you know, you turn to the kind of sternest thing, you know, the thing that is undeniably not what you had been part of. And, you know, that's a little bit part of, I think, where he ended up.
When he got back to London this week after being deported from the U.S., he told the young London press, "Half of me wants to smile, half of me wants to growl." He said he hoped it had all been a big mistake. He said the whole thing is totally ridiculous. David Wilde, you spent time with him. Your impressions of the man behind the public furor here.
It's a difficult question because I admire the artist tremendously. I like the man tremendously. The issues are nonetheless still difficult, and I know that, you know, the irony of getting to know him and you know, and sitting with him at dinner and winning a Muslim Public Policy Award in 2001 of all years, yeah. And then a few weeks later, I reached out to him again because I was the head writer for the Tribute to Heroes telethon after 9/11, the all-network event, and the only thing I knew about the Quran was what he had told me. So I remember emailing back and forth and trying to craft a statement of tolerance. And the issue's just, you know, I think of the man who sat and sang those songs to me. He wouldn't pick up a guitar, but he sang them a cappella to me as we were putting together this project. And, you know, the music spoke so beautifully, and I think he probably wishes he had always spoken that beautifully. and I think if he could take back a few things, or certainly the phrasing of a few things that he said, he would do that.
Well, The old music still plays, whether he sings it or not. And what a fascinating story. David Wilde in Los Angeles, producer of the 2000 VH1 special on Cat Stevens, Yusuf Islam. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
And Anthony DeCurtis in New York, author of Rocking My Life Away. Wonderful to have you. Thanks very much for diving in with us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Behind us, of course, from 1971, from the album Teaser and the Firecat, Moonshadow by Cat Stevens. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
As I'm being followed by a moonshadow, 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 leaping and hopping on a moonshadow, moonshadow, moonshadow. And if I ever lose my hands, lose my plow, lose my land, oh, if I ever lose my hands away, I won't have to work no more. And if I ever lose my eyes, if my colors all run dry, yes, if I ever lose my eyes away,
in a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
Every nation that wants peace will share the benefits of a freer world. And every nation that seeks peace has an obligation to help build that world.
His miscalculations were not the equivalent of accounting errors. They were colossal failures of judgment, and judgment is what we look for in a president.
Those who seek to bestow legitimacy must themselves embody it. And those who invoke international law must themselves submit to it.
I'm sure I'll watch his mother. It's of no use keeping her mother in prison. No use whatsoever. Let the most back to the children. Give these people.
Let's say you tried to have an election and you could have it in 3/4 or 4/5 of the country, but some places you couldn't because the violence was too great. Well, that's so be it. Nothing's perfect in life. So you have an election that's not quite perfect. Is it better than not having an election? You bet.
We're talking about diplomacy and political efforts to stop this movement on the part of the Iranians toward a nuclear weapon, and we're not talking about strikes, but every option always, of course, remains on the table.
It was 30 hours of rain, but what seems to be clear is that some rain, some storms that wouldn't have such a great effect on other countries. In Haiti, it really destroys so many buildings, so many lives, largely because of deforestation.
The failure of CBS News to do just that, to properly, fully scrutinize the documents and their source, led to our airing the documents when we should not have done so. It was a mistake. CBS News deeply regrets it. Also, I want to say personally and directly, I'm sorry.
And there is a week. President Bush seeks world support for Iraq, telling the United Nations that everyone has a stake in that country's success. His Democratic rival, John Kerry, sharpens his critique of the Iraq war and draws clear lines between himself and the president. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, in perhaps a subtle jab at President Bush, says that every nation is subject to international law. A British hostage pleads for his life on videotape after two Americans kidnapped along with him are beheaded in Iraq. Authorities believe it's all the work of terrorist leader Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld says elections will be held in Iraq, even if the security situation there keeps sections of the country from being able to vote. Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage seemed to contradict Rumsfeld today when he said elections must be open to all. Secretary of State Colin Powell says a military strike on Iran is unlikely, even though Tehran announced earlier in the week that it has begun preparing to enrich uranium. Hurricane Jean kills more than 1,100 in Haiti, and CBS anchor Dan Rather apologizes for relying on what turned out to be false documents in a story about President Bush's National Guard service. But Jack, the big story of the week is this deep line now drawn between the president and John Kerry over Iraq. John Kerry setting out in firm and for the first time very clear and very critical opposition to the president holding firm.
Yes, Kerry's speech on Monday in New York really was the opening gun of the stretch of this campaign. You know, hitherto he had been saying it's the way the president did it. I would have done it, but it was the way he did it. Everything he did was wrong. Now he's also saying I wouldn't have done it, and that the president's saying, even knowing everything he does know now, that he would still do it shows a willful, obliviousness to reality. And that word comes up again and again in Kerry's speeches. The president showed bad judgment. He was out of touch with reality then. And now Kerry is saying he's out of touch with reality again. He's pointing to, he's juxtaposing what we see in the newspapers and on television to the hopeful statements, optimistic statements that Prime Minister Alawi and Mr. Bush gave the other day about Iraq, and saying, look, he's still out of touch with reality.
So he's saying rosy scenario in the Rose Garden, colossal failures of judgment, and he's pounding that home. And, of course, the Bush people are pounding back every day and saying, we're just doing what it takes. You've got to be strong. It's not going to be easy. Many people disagreeing with the way they portray Iraq, but they say we will soldier on. What works here, Jack?
Well, we don't know. I haven't seen any poll results yet on new reactions to Kerry since his speech. And, of course, the Republicans rightly say this is yet another tack from Kerry, another change in course, or at least in rhetorical emphasis. So, you know, it's sort of while it seems to make Kerry seem stronger, for some voters it may reinforce the notion of him as a flip-flopper. So it's hard to know how that's going to come out. But I do think it's bad for a president when what he's saying is so contradicted by the news. Now, Bush is saying we need to take the long view. Obviously, this is going to be difficult. We're hopeful. But when the news is just so bad, it can create credibility problems for the president, which gets us right back to, you know, how we get into the war in the first place, which is the Kerry point. He was duplicitous, or at least wrong about the claims about Iraq then, and he's wrong now looking forward. It isn't going to be as easy as he says. I mean, not that he's saying it's going to be easy, but it's not the prospect is nothing to be hopeful about.
It's a fascinating calculus. I mean, credibility problems, perhaps, but on the other hand, if voters are going to stand by Bush and look at that far horizon that he likes to describe, where someday, you know, everything will be better, and the only way we get there is by going through the flames here, could he actually win support through that?
I think he could. I mean, he does for always come up with the long view, both strategically, this is the only way to stop terrorism by creating legitimate governments in the Middle East, and sort of ideologically, America is on a crusade for freedom. We've liberated 50 million Muslims from tyranny in the last 2 years. We're on the march. So he's got the high road. He's got the strategic road. He's on those goals. But it's getting between here and there that seems such a great leap. And Kerry is kind of caught. I mean, he can't really argue with those goals. But on the other hand, if he lets Bush just keep our focus on those goals, he won't be able to, you know, hit him on the way he's going about it.
And what's actually happening, of course,
yeah.
Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld always ready to put things in his perspective. Nothing's perfect in life. Oh, boy.
What did he say about the looting? Stuff happens.
Stuff happens. Tell it to the Iraqis. Jack, have a great weekend. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.